This is Building Bridges, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Boarding that Greyhound bus to travel through the heart of the Deep South, I felt good. I felt happy. I felt liberated. I was like a soldier in a nonviolent army. I was ready.
I'm on my way.
I'm sorry, our management does not allow us to serve niggers in here.
The Freedom Rides of 1961 were a simple but daring plan to put blacks and whites on commercial buses. They would deliberately violate the segregation laws.
These people are going from town to town and getting off the bus, Negro men and white women, to provoke acts of violence.
The idea of going into Mississippi and going into Alabama and challenging segregation so frontally is something that alarmed not only those who opposed civil rights, but those within the civil rights community.
I don't question their legal right to travel, but I question their wisdom. Some people can get hurt.
There was that feeling. I'd just like to punch some of them damn agitators right in the face.
There was a mob looking like 1,000 people. They had these iron pipes.
They were screaming, kill them niggas, and they had babies in their arm.
I asked God to be with me, to give me the strength I would need to remain nonviolent and to forgive them.
We'll take hitting, we'll take beating. We're willing to accept death. But we're going to keep coming until we can ride from anywhere in the South to any place else in the South.
Buses are a-coming, oh yes. Buses are a-coming, oh yes.
It was America. It was interracial. It was interregional. It was secular and religious. It was a shining moment.
Your parents tell you, don't start something that you can't finish. Finish it.
Well, even a short trailer of the Freedom Rides creates a stirring in me for one of the most important periods in our history, where people rose up in the most democratic of manners and effectively broke the back of Jim Crow in the South. In Nashville in 1960, the students began the sit-in movement, attempting to be served at the lunch counters of downtown department stores. Presente, Diane Nash. Nash was a full-time field worker with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC. She rode one of the Freedom Buses, where she endured both mob violence and imprisonment. Later, Nash was hired by the Southern Christian Leadership Conference as field worker and liaison with SNCC. She was also a major organizer for the 1963 campaign in Birmingham.
Reverend James Lawson helped found and lead the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and coordinate the 1961 Freedom Ride. He was an advance worker for Birmingham Civil Rights Activities in 1963, and he helped plan the James Meredith March in Mississippi in 1966 and also helped organize the 1968 Memphis Sanitation Workers' Strike. In the spring of 1968, Lawson invited Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. to speak in Memphis, Tennessee. A day after giving the Mountaintop Sermon on April 4, 1968, Dr. King was assassinated in Memphis. Indeed, in that Mountaintop speech, King had referred to Lawson as one of the noble men who had influenced the black freedom struggle. King also called Lawson the leading nonviolence theorist in the world. Lawson has also continued to protest over poverty, Iraq, gay and lesbian issues, Central America, and racial profiling.
Today, a lot of people feel that they are helpless. But in listening to and learning from Diane Nash and Reverend James Lawson, their experience will teach us methods for bringing about social and political change and fortify our spirit to pursue change. And it is an absolute honor to have with us Diane Nash and the Reverend James Lawson. Diane also is at a conference because this is a pivotal moment, really, in the history of the Freedom Rides. Diane, tell us just a little bit about the conference you're at and the reconvening of the Freedom Riders at this time.
Well, this is the 50th anniversary of the Freedom Rides. And we are celebrating that occasion with the reunion and conference in Chicago, Illinois. We've had panels of Freedom Riders who have told their stories. And then we've had members who were part of the Justice Department under Robert Kennedy as panelists. John Sigenthaler was an assistant to Robert Kennedy. And John Doerr was an attorney for the Justice Department and assistant attorney general. And then today we are talking about current injustices that still need to be solved. Some of our panelists today were the mother of the young man who was found hanging from a tree in Mississippi on December 3rd, 2010. And we are going to try to seek competent investigations for that young man, as well as so many who have been found under questionable circumstances recently, and cold cases as well.
And we also have been joined by James Lawson, who we understand is actually in the same hotel as Diane Nash. And
yes, this is where the conference is.
You know, the Freedom Riders, the Poor People's March, so many of the activities that were put together by young people during the civil rights era were a source of inspiration and motion and movement that really created substantive change. Reverend Lawson, help us understand some of the methodology. What were the issues that brought people together and made them, despite the enormity of the obstacles to their very lives, become such brilliant organizers? How did the movement coalesce?
That question is a very big question. One could challenge the notion that the movement arrived at a place of coalescence, because what we call the civil rights movement has to be seen in its huge, in its size, the numbers of different dimensions of work. For example, cannot exclude from the civil rights movement to desegregate schools. That would be one whole dimension of the movement. What I think you want to talk about is the emergence of direct nonviolent action, which dramatized the issues in such a powerful way and with such good numbers over and over again that it became, in a very real way, the engine for the whole movement. People acting upon their own in conjunction with one another and developing plans and strategies for direct action. That part of the movement also did not ever actually coalesce, but it was on its way to it because we had at least 8 or 9 major campaigns of direct action that did not include the many company actions of direct action that would often be scattered around the Southeast and around the country. For example, the sit-in campaign had support actions in almost every state of the Union in 1960. So a part of the heart of that direct action movement, I would say very quickly, was the fact that we in Nashville followed a Gandhian methodology for approaching the desegregation of downtown Nashville, and we were able to use ways of training people across 3-4 months period, and then again within the context of the direct action, and those people who took on very strongly nonviolent struggle, direct action theory and practice in turn also helped to train another sizable group of people. And that apparatus did spread in the early part of the decade, actually, all across the Southeast and influenced many, many, many local struggles.
Diane, when Dr. Lawson brings up the tactic of direct action, I think what we see a lot of times, and certainly I watched the movie Freedom Riders last night, I thought it was wonderful. one action influencing another action, even though they are not coordinated from some superior above coordinator. Do you want to talk about why we call this a movement?
I think the sheer huge numbers of people who were participating in the country would warrant calling it a movement. But inside the movement, there were many projects and campaigns. I think the whole thing altogether, starting probably with 1960 and the sit-ins, which broke out really across the South, and then moving to the Freedom Rides and the Voting Rights Campaign, other efforts to desegregate public accommodation. I think all of those together would constitute a movement. But I think that there definitely were many instances where one project influenced another. The sit-ins, probably in my lifetime, is where things began. Incidentally, I would like to just say that Reverend Lawson had been to India and had studied Gandhi's movement firsthand and was in Nashville, Tennessee in 1959 and 60, of course, and taught the philosophy and strategy of nonviolence to many of us who were students and to community people also. When sit-ins began in North Carolina, we in Nashville and students in many cities throughout the country began to sit in at the same chain stores as the gentleman in Greensboro, North Carolina, sat in. And it just spread like wildfire.
There are so many abuses now that impact on people's lives. The poverty is so deep, and it is unabated, and certainly does not appear that any time in the future it will be. There are issues of democracy. Bentonville, Michigan, with the entire city, which is primarily African American, has been taken over by an emergency financial manager who has completely usurped local government. Or Wisconsin, while people came out by the tens and tens of thousands, the groundswell seems to have quieted. What happened in the civil rights movement that sparked such attention and grabbed people to become, whether it was about pacifism or not? They sat in at lunch counters. They did voter registration. They organized, and things grew to creating poor people campaigns, to the sanitation strike in Memphis. What brought people out to put themselves at such risk and fight for against the oppression that they felt at that period? Dr. Lawson?
A social movement is much more of a social organism than a static entity with simple principles. It's more complex. On the one hand, you had an extremely repressive and tyrannical social, economic, racial, sexual, political, cultural society, especially in the Southeast. Sign of all sorts of segregation and hostility. White hostility in so many places, so many communities with so many different activities, whether bus drivers or teachers or clerk in the shopping areas or gasoline station operators. So the fact that we had that was very important. Secondly, the fact that people had always resisted that in various ways, not in mass, not in numbers that caused a lot of tumult, but nevertheless, there's always been a resistance. The slave, the black slave in the United States never accepted the slavery. Black people never accepted the agony and tension and suffering of Jim Crow law in practice. So there were many preparatory things to help the mind. But I would say to you that systematically, the movement you're talking about developed in an intensity from around 1953 to 1973, where almost every single year in that 20-year period, there were major events and major struggles. Those struggles, in turn, impacted other people, woke them up. Even the folk who called themselves down the road in the 60s, Black Power, were a consequence of the courage, of the character, of the struggle that took place, let me say, quite specifically in Montgomery, Alabama, in Orangeburg, South Carolina, in the sit-in campaign, and I would say especially in the effectiveness of the disciplined campaign in Nashville, Tennessee, in 1962 in Albany, Georgia, 61 the Freedom Ride, 62 Albany, Georgia, Birmingham campaign in 1983, and as these things progressed and moved, I've said already there were activities that sought to imitate. There are people then who woke up in other places, and so that meant many actions besides just what the Freedom Ride was as an illustration. But then 64, the Mississippi Summer, these were all actions of direct action where people put their lives on the line. And nonviolent struggle has that peculiar characteristic in that as people view that locally, regionally, and nationally, many other people wake up to the task that some of us have begun. You therefore get Selma Montgomery, 65. Again, that gave a great boost to voting registration projects all over the country, but especially in the South Central. Then the Mississippi, the March Against Fear in 1966. So what I'm saying to you is that there was an intensified, and they fed on each other. The folk who took nonviolent, heavy nonviolent training and discipline and practiced it, became more confident in it. So that, for example, the Freedom Ride was made more effective by the Nashville movement and many of us who went to jail in Jackson and the work that Diane and many others did. 62 Albany movement was given advantage because Charles Sherrard and a number of other people were impacted by the teaching out of the Nashville group of people that they met in other places around the Southeast. The Birmingham campaign was modeled after the Nashville desegregation movement of 1960. So that's what a social movement is. As it develops, it does wake up more people, it trains more people, it recruits more people. It has to have the intensity to begin to really make things accomplished. We maybe now have not even accomplished in getting the no colored people, no Jew signs, the no WAP signs, the no Mexican signs. We may not have got them all pulled down, but that started to happen in 1960 in Nashville, and it spread systematically with the Freedom Ride of 1961. The Albany movement gave it a great impetus. Birmingham movement gave it impetus. The Johnson administration passed the 1964 Civil Rights Bill, which made such signs unconstitutional and illegal. And that was a major impetus. We had restaurants in Nashville that did not desegregate and serve Black people until the Civil Rights Bill was passed. We had some protracted battles in a number of restaurants in Nashville who were just hard-nosed, resistant to that little bit of change until some cases after the Civil Rights Bill was passed. In other cases, they even then had to be essentially coerced, pushed to change.
Well, just to add to what Jim has said, I think that in terms of motivation, Black people had really had it with segregation. Those signs and segregation were all designed to make you feel inferior and beat a person down psychologically. I know when I would obey the segregation signs or use the back door, I felt like I was agreeing that I was somehow so inferior that I didn't deserve to use the front door like, you know, ordinary people. And I think that after close to 100 years of that, Black people had really just had it and were ready to move against it. The things you mentioned in the town in Michigan, that's very serious. We have been lulled into thinking that we can maintain democracy with very little effort. I would like to say a couple of things about that. In a democracy where the citizens are supposed to be in charge of our own lives, the citizens are supposed to be the rulers of this country. But the American citizens do not see ourselves as rulers of the country, and we'd really better change our mindset. Voting is not enough. Voting is important, but spending 10 minutes in a voting booth every 2 years is not going to produce the society that we need and want. I think we are going to have to stop depending on elected officials to do what needs to be done. And I like to say, can you imagine how long it might have taken us to desegregate lunch counters and interstate bus travel, public accommodations, if we had waited for public officials to do it?
Exactly.
We might still be waiting.
That's right. And also, had we waited until the white community moved to modify things, as some people, public people, recommended, we should have waited for modification from the white community. They were not going to do it.
Reverend Lawson, the impetus for the strike in Memphis, which seemed to be a pivotal point of the coming together of economic and democratic rights, the civil rights, with the reality that if you don't have a job, or if you're not getting paid a decent wage, you're not going to be able to have the money, so that even if you do desegregate that lunch counter, you're not going to be able to buy the proverbial hamburger in it. What was the significance of the Memphis strike and that coming together of economic and civil rights?
A number of things. One, the workers had had a C.O. Jones, sanitation worker himself, who for 6 years was fired before 1968. He had tried to organize and was working to organize a union in 1733 and was slowly persuading people the necessity of getting organized and making demands. That organization process had been successful enough so that when the two men in early February were tragically crushed to death on a malfunctioning mechanism on a garbage truck, the workers simply walked off the job February 12th in mass. So the whole thing that nonviolent theory and practice pushes is that there has to be a process of organizing and strategizing, and that process has to gain sufficient power in and of itself within the local locality so it can then move on to be an effective direct action struggle. So it was those things together. And then when they went on strike after that accident and all, many of us in Memphis simply supported them, people who wanted fairness and dignity and justice for them. Those people were in civic, religious, fraternal organizations around the community. So a number of us in our churches began to raise money in order to help feed them, because there were no such thing as a strike fund, and they were themselves destitute, though they were working 15, 60 hours a week. Themselves were in the midst of deep, structured poverty. It was a process of organizing, mass meeting, daily marches, economic boycott in downtown area, constant confrontation of the mayor, city council, a variety of trying to negotiate through pressure through white businessmen who wanted the strike ended, as well as through clergy who sought to negotiate in various ways. So here again, it was an organizing process of teaching people about the union and all. 6 years before, and then the strike arrived, the continuing organizing process that mobilized and organized a sizable black community, its civic organizations, its churches, many of the black business people, business organizations, backed the strike and saw the strike in a singular way as a symbol of the racism and the economic exploitation that racism is, and of the society of Memphis denying black workers access to the kinds of resources where they could sustain themselves and their families with all their own basic needs.
Diane, in the last minute that we have, how would you analyze what you think is the response that we need, or how to galvanize a mass response to the conditions that people face today?
I think we need to understand that there is no one to make the changes that need to be made except you and me. I think people waste valuable time wishing for a great leader or wishing the elected officials would do something or expecting somebody other than the person they see in the mirror to do things. Now, one lady said to me when I said something like that, but I'm just one little person. And the fact is, we're all just one little person. But I think we need to see ourselves as catalysts and use our creativity to design how we are going to move. I think we need to get our neighbors organized, people in our clubs, churches, organizations. I often think when I read in the newspaper, when you see the G14 heads of countries, I think now a lot of people are seeing this on TV and reading this in the newspaper. Don't we all know that they are not going to be making economic decisions that are going to benefit us, the ordinary citizen? Why are we just reading about this and doing nothing instead of organizing groups in our block to decide how we want the economy of this country to go and to decide how we are going to make those things happen?
Gandhi said that dictatorship requires the consent of the people. Racism requires the consent of the people. Gandhi said that every person had the power not to consent to the wrong, to the tyranny, whatever it is. And when sufficient numbers of people decided not to consent, then that tyranny, that government, has to recognize that issue is going to collapse. They're going to have no power over it.
And they did that in Egypt in many ways, and maybe
exactly,
we can take our inspiration from them.
Exactly.
We're going to have to continue and have a longer conversation. We have been speaking to two absolute icons on this, the 50th anniversary of the Freedom Rides, who have given us a good deal of pause and things to think about. And for your contributions, then and ongoing contributions, we do honor you, Diane Nash and the Reverend James Lawson. It has been a pleasure speaking with both of you. Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.